Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
They say that steel gets stronger when you throw it in the fire. They say that steel gets stronger when you throw it in the fire.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Bonnie Montgomery and Amy Garland? Y'all like Bonnie and Amy? Bonnie Montgomery and Amy Garland are Arkansas's premier singer-songwriters and play on many different projects. More can be found at BonnieMontgomeryMusic.com. All right, well, welcome to a very special edition of Tales from the South, the second of our two-part End Hate shows, where LGBT Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Oyster Bar in the Capitol View Stiff Station neighborhood of Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and tonight's show is sponsored by the Arkansas Stonewall Democratic Caucus. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here playing for us tonight is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here tonight? Y'all like our set? We are thrilled to partner again with esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox and her End Hate conceptual art series, based on labels once placed on doors not that long ago from our shameful past. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and VL at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight's show is part two of our two-part End Hate series, with the goal of bringing people together through the power of storytelling and breaking down the doors and walls of discrimination. All stories are true and told by the LGBT Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Jill Duvall and her partner end up in the ER in a sticky situation, and we'll end the night with Rebecca Buchanan, a close friend, and a chance encounter. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Debbie Stewart several decades back in 1982.
The year was 1982. There was an emergency phone call at my work from my brother. Sis, Jay died. Jay was his lover of several years. Jay had only been sick a couple of weeks. It was the gay man's disease. Steve said I had left the hospital to go home for a nap. The phone was ringing when I entered our apartment. By the time I got back to the hospital, everything from his room, including his personal effects, were sitting outside on the sidewalk. My heart broke for Steve, but honestly, I was afraid for him. Could he now get this gay man's disease? Jay was Jewish. Stevie wasn't. Jay's family was very good to Stevie. At the funeral, they asked him to sit Shiva, which was quite an honor. He overheard Jay's aunt ask, "Is that the Shiksa?" Stevie took that as a compliment. It means Gentile wife. I always knew Steve was gay. I think the whole family did, but he had the most kind and gentle spirit that no one cared. He lived with me right out of high school, and in the 80s, still early in his 20s, decided to move to New York City. Yeah, right, I thought. He'll be back in a month. But not so. He loved it there, and I believed his southern manners and gentleness made him successful. I went to visit him to try to give him some comfort, but really so I could just treasure time with him. And we spent the evenings laying in his king-size bed watching Woody Allen movies. He seemed to think that was comforting. He eventually met a nice Italian, Jack. It had been several years, and Steve had shown no sign of what was now called AIDS. He and Jack settled into a quiet life. They visited Arkansas several times, which was culture shock to Jack. I took them to hot springs for baths and massages. They loved that. I visited them several times, and we explored the Cathedral of St. John the Divine and lots of museums. During those years, we talked on the phone at least twice a week. There were no computers then, no Skype, no email, no Facebook. Jack was an artist, and they made me the artsy cards and sent them often. One Christmas when Steve visited, he gave me the VCR tape of the movie The Maltese Falcon. I said, "Thank you, I will watch this on my friend's VCR." I don't have one yet. When I opened my next gift, it was a VCR. They were a new invention and quite expensive. I thought, oh, is he sick and aware of it? Several years later, at the age of 30, I met a woman I knew I loved, Laura. Surprise! Neither she nor I had ever been with another woman, but we both just knew it was right. Our families took it in their stride. Everyone just wanted us to be happy. Steve had paved the way for me. He was thrilled. The fact that we now belong to the same club brought us even closer, I believe. Always in the back of my mind, I wondered if Steve would get AIDS. Then in October of 1989, I got the call. Steve had experienced a seizure and was rushed to the hospital, where they thought he might have liver cancer that had metastasized to his brain. We knew that wasn't what was wrong. We knew. In a matter of days, the doctor called. She said, "If you want to see your brother while he still knows who you are, you should come." Laura and I flew there immediately. Jack and Laura stayed outside the room while I, swallowing hard, approached my brother's bed. He lit up. "Steve," I said, "do you remember when we were little and I ran over you with my bicycle?" "Yes, I remember," he smiled. "Do you forgive me?" "Sis," he said, 40 years from now, if you think of something you want to be forgiven for, you have a blanket forgiveness. We hugged, we cried. He was glowing. His skin was glowing. His eyes were bright. He was unafraid. "I pray you will be healed," I said. "Sis, your idea of me being healed and God's idea of me being healed may be two different things. You have to put me in his hands, even if I die." Over a few weeks, his diagnosis was official. It was AIDS. But his immediate health improved. He was prescribed AZT, which was the only AIDS drug available at that time. I came back to Arkansas and poured myself into the AIDS scene. It was horrible. There were people begging organizations to get involved, and the overall thought seemed to be, why? There is no AIDS in Arkansas. Actually, there are no homosexuals in Arkansas. I heard horror stories of people dying and their bodies weren't claimed, young men dying alone in hospitals. There were men in rural parts of Arkansas who couldn't get to Little Rock to be treated. There were heroes during that time too, thank goodness. There were some people who legislated for vans to get rural patients help. A woman in Hot Springs who buried young men in a cemetery on some property she owned, free of charge. Steve took his illness in stride, and he had good days and bad days. He built an altar in his apartment, hung mobiles, and bought a machine that projected rainbows on the walls. He visited us, and we tried to help him concentrate on living, not dying. One Christmas, I awoke in the middle of the night to see the Christmas tree lights were turned on. I got up to turn them off, and there was Steve lying on his back with his head under the tree. In 1991, Steve called to say, "I need you here." Our dad had suffered a stroke, and our mother couldn't handle the thought that he was dying. It didn't matter that it was AIDS that it was killing, just that it was the death of her child. Steve said, "I need someone whose focus is me. My boss gave me all the time I needed, assuring me that I would still have a job when I got back." Steve was housebound by this time, and Jack worked, so I moved in. We talked about everything, what he wanted done with his body, his possessions, what he thought heaven would be like. His eyes bothered him, so we went to the doctor who loved him and was there anytime we needed her. She sent him to the eye doctor who said, "Steve, you're going blind from cytomegalovirus. You have to go to the hospital." Steve said, "No. My sis and I are going to Rockefeller Center to watch the lighting of the Christmas tree. We are making a memory. Then I will go to the hospital." When he went to the hospital, he was entered, for a fee, into a ward that was extra nice. There was no waiting for admission, and there were three nurses for every patient. They had a chef who made shrimp cocktail and filet mignon. Steve called for the chef to come to his room, and she was afraid he was going to complain about the food, but he hugged her and asked for some home fries and gravy. I think she would have come south just to get it for him if she could have. The health system and people in general had been educated by now about AIDS, and there was compassion coming from everywhere for Steve. He visited other patients on his good days, and the nurses pampered him on his bad days. The whole hospital seemed to know about him and his wonderful attitude. Hospital janitors brought their children to visit with pictures they had drawn for him. He greeted them with balloon hats. We got invited to observe the lighting of a menorah at the hospital, and Steve recited the prayer in Hebrew to everyone's wet-eyed surprise. We watched the New Year's fireworks in the harbor from his hospital room with him wearing a party hat. On the day Steve died, I said, "I'm sorry you can't see." He said, "Sis, I am going to see God with my eyes wide open." And then he said, "I hear a bird singing and making a fuss." And then he was gone. We had him cremated and brought home to the Cotton Plant, Arkansas cemetery. The hearse was filled with balloons, and everyone had a bottle of bubbles, and there was a recording of Kermit the Frog singing Rainbow Connection. As we let go of the balloons, unplanned, everyone started singing I'll Fly Away. In the background, a killdeer started singing and making the biggest fuss. The louder we sang, the louder she sang. The New York boy had come home. As Laura and I reflect back on our 29 years together, 24 without Steve, we have seen so much progress with acceptance of homosexuality, and the AIDS virus has become a disease that is no longer a death sentence. I think Steve is smiling.
Debbie Stewart is an amateur wildlife photographer who lives on Lake Conway in Arkansas with her significant other and her two dogs. Next on Tales from the South, let's go with Jill Duvall and her longtime girlfriend to the delivery room in Lucky Girl.
We had picked a local small hospital for the birth of our twins because it was close to our house and we knew at least one other lesbian who had delivered there. We thought this might increase the odds of no overt discrimination during the delivery of our twin babies. The babies, conceived through artificial insemination, were to be born in late July, so we were shocked to find ourselves in the emergency department on June the 1st. The doctor came in with the bad news. "Ladies," he said, "I'm afraid the babies can't be stopped at this point. So we're going to need to transfer you all to the state hospital where there's an intensive care unit." We agreed to the plan, although disappointed, but whatever needed to be done to take care of our babies and Anne. However, the doctor continued, "I want to talk to you about another concern." The doctor moved closer to the bed and sat down. I was sure he'd seen something wrong with one of the babies on the ultrasound. He had this really sad look on his face. Here at this hospital where I work every day, I know everyone, and I can protect you. But where we're going, I'm not sure I can. Our doctor shook his head in worry. He continued, I could just go through your medical record, take out any information that would expose your relationship. I think this would be the best way to protect you. Hiding and lying by omission, we knew that strategy well. Although Ann and I had been together for 9 years at this point, we, like many other gay people, had hid and lied to our family and friends for years. I told my dad first a few years after we got together. I went home for a visit to Arkansas, and for some reason, I chose to tell him while he was chopping wood beside the house under a tall pine tree. Dad, I have something I feel I need to tell you. He slammed the axe into the wood. No, you don't, honey. Your life is your life, and you don't have to tell me nothing. But, Dad, this is really important, and I want you to know, and I think I should tell you this. Look, honey, he protested. I don't care if you've been arrested or are pregnant or working in the sex trade. He slammed the axe down again. I'm like, Dad, it is not any of those. It's just that I'm gay, and Ann and I are more than friends. He looked at me with that axe pulled back over his head, and yes, for a brief moment, I thought he might kill me. But he laid the axe down and walked over and gave me a hug. Then he went right back to chopping woods and gave me some strange lecture about taking care of myself and that there was no need for everyone to know. And I'm thinking, it's like taking me years to tell one person, and he now thinks I'm going to tell the world. Anne's path of telling her parents was longer, and it was after we'd been together 5 years. She wrote her mom and dad a letter, and we anxiously waited for a response. It didn't take long. Anne's parents wrote back reassuring her of their constant love and speaking of other gay people that had been in her family. But our delivery doctor, who was trying to protect us, posed an interesting question. Could we, should we, go back into the closet for just a little while? We did discuss it there in the hospital room with Anne having contractions, but told the sweet doctor to not alter the medical records, to just be honest, and that we were prepared to deal with whatever happened. That was a lie, of course, but it sounded right at the time. The birth of our children went fast, and our two gorgeous babies were born 8 weeks early and rushed off to the neonatal intensive care unit. We entered the world of sick babies and specialized care. Our children were struggling to breathe, and it didn't look good. 12 hours after delivery, we were called to meet with the intensive care unit social worker. This terrified us due to believing that social workers often told families of bad news. We were both shaking and frantic by the time the meeting occurred. The social worker began. The team has asked me to talk to you about a concern they have on the unit. I felt sick to my stomach. I looked over at Anne, and she looked like someone had already died. The social worker continued, when the team, the doctors and nurses are working with your babies, they would like to know what to call you. They normally say things like your mom and dad will be here shortly, but they don't want to use the wrong language with your children. Are you kidding me? I could almost not believe my ears. The medical staff at the hospital were trying to be sweet to us. We were prepared for mean people and snide remarks, but we were not prepared for that. Plus, we had not really thought about this aspect of what the boys would call us, so we encouraged the staff to refer to us as Ann and Jill to the babies. Once they were toddlers, they ended up calling us Mama Ann and Mama Jill. A few days later, we did learn that one respiratory therapist asked to be removed from the care of our children due to his uncomfortableness with us. But at the time, the staff in the intensive care unit kept this from us. The boys came home, and life with twins began. We were a little worried about our fathers, who still lived in our hometown, a small rural place in Arkansas where they both had lived all of their lives. A few weeks after the boys came home from the hospital, they ran into each other on a sidewalk downtown. My dad reported that they high-fived each other on the street, and Ann's father exclaimed, "Two grandsons at once." It would be untrue to say that we have never run into any difficulties because of our relationship. But to be honest, the few mean people and occasional whacked out politicians are seriously outnumbered by kind people stepping out to assist us, to protect us, and to make sure that we're part of the community we live in. Although when I first was worried as a teen that I was gay, I was scared of what the future held. Little did I know that my future held true love, twin sons, a relationship that has lasted 34 years so far, good friends from all walks of life, and a loving extended family. If I'd only known that as a teenager, I would have been a lot less worried, because at this point, I simply think of myself as one lucky girl from Arkansas.
Jill Duvall is a writer and social worker who lives in her hometown in Arkansas with her long-term girlfriend and twin sons. She is working on her second mystery novel. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Rebecca Buchanan gets her socks knocked off in That Day.
I was wearing a t-shirt with a cartoon cow with extremely large pink udders on it. I cannot tell you why I was wearing it. Something in my mid-20s brain must have thought that I was way cool. My pink endowed cow did not escape the attention of my friend Judy. She pointed at me and laughed, and I smiled and walked to her side. "Hey, Judy, you like my t-shirt?" I asked. The cow had two words and a clock printed beneath it. It said, "Utter time." Judy took my hand and pulled me close. With concentration and a bit of eye rolling, she pointed at the cow and said, "Mr. Jesus," and then laughed. I was so pleased to hear her voice that I almost cried. "Mr. Jesus," I repeated. "Yes, Mr. Jesus." Later, I would take a black Sharpie and write "Mr. Jesus" under "utter time." Judy was my best friend back in the 80s. I was out of college and living at home, trying to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. A few months before Mr. Jesus, Judy helped me through a traumatic breakup with my second girlfriend. Concerned that I would become a man-hater and move to women's land, which was my secret dream, Judy announced one Saturday, "We are going to drive up the pig trail to Fayetteville so I can introduce you to all my lesbian friends." Reluctantly, I climbed into her tiny Datsun and off we went through the winding hills of the Ozarks. We arrived at the University of Arkansas and Judy started making phone calls. Well, two phone calls, actually, but both with no answer. Then she announced that we would make a home visit, but there was no car in the driveway. "That's it," she said. "I have one other lesbian friend, but she lives in Eureka Springs and it's too late to drive that far." She looked defeated and I felt depressed as she turned the car toward Highway 71. We were just about to leave town when she decided we would make one last stop at Ozark Natural Foods in Fayetteville. At the time, I was a Dr. Pepper fan with a taste for cheap chocolate. I had never been in a store with more than one kind of lettuce. Needless to say, I was disappointed by the carob-covered raisins and the natural soda I scored. Judy wandered around, grinding her own organic coffee, choosing a few good blood oranges, filling a large bag with black lentils. She was at home. But I was lost. Lost, that is, until I heard a voice from across the room. I remember thinking, "That is the sweetest voice that I've ever heard." I peeked around some jars of pickled beets and I saw her. this strong, tan, beautiful older woman in running shorts, a tank top, and a pair of worn Teva river sandals. She was paying for her groceries and chatting up the girl at the register. I realized that I had to do something fast or she would be out the door. I had no idea whether this woman was alone or maybe straight. I had no clue. All I knew is that I had to meet her. I headed toward the front of the store with her in my sight and produce on my mind. She told me later that she had seen me lurking and remembered me as this strange presence in the organic potatoes. I was not lurking, I was stalking. I moved in close, this time within speaking distance, and I grabbed the first thing that I could find, hoping to strike up a conversation with this beautiful woman in the river sandals. Earwax candles. I knew absolutely nothing about them, but lucky for me, she knew everything. I can't recall the ear candling conversation today, except to say that it was the prelude to another conversation that I will never forget. Judy walked around the corner and said, "Oh, Becky, you two have met." And I was stunned. She went on, "This is my friend Arbor from Eureka Springs that I was telling you about. She's the friend I wanted you to meet." She did not wink at me, but she should have. After all her good intentions and failed attempts, she had finally introduced me to one of her three lesbian friends. The friend who lived an hour away and that we were not supposed to meet that day. After our brief conversation, we said our goodbyes. Arbor headed to her car and I headed to Judy's, and my head was spinning. I sat in Judy's car, frantically trying to memorize Arbor's name. Such an unusual name, I knew I would never be able to remember it. I kept repeating out loud, "Arbor, Arbor, think of it like a brush arbor, a revival. Arbor, I have to remember that name." It turns out there was a very good reason that I had to remember that name. A few days later, I was working at my job as the prep cook at the Ozark Restaurant and Pancake House when the manager called me to the phone. I'd never gotten a phone call at work before. "Hello," I said. It was a mutual friend on the other end, speaking very slowly. "They found Judy unconscious near the road." Then she said a lot of words that blurred into sounds, and then a sentence I could understand. Her Scotty was hit by a car. More blurring sounds, and then I snapped back and caught the rest. "Becky, they think she had a brain aneurysm from the shock. They are taking her to Sparks Hospital in Fort Smith, and they don't think she'll make it." The rest of the afternoon, I moved in slow motion. I would like to tell you all I thought of that day was Judy, but I can't tell you that in all honesty. I had already forgotten that beautiful woman's first name, as hard as I had tried to memorize it that day in the parking lot of Ozark Natural Foods. And I never knew her last name. My friend Judy, whose brain was now drowning in her own blood, was our one and only connection. As soon as I processed the reality that I had to let go of any hope ever of seeing this woman again, my thoughts then turned only to Judy. I headed to the hospital that evening and saw her every few days thereafter. She lay in a warm coma, unconscious and unresponsive. I spoke to her, rubbed her soft hands, and thanked her for her friendship, for caring for me after the breakup when I was so sad and very lonely. The doctors gave little hope, allowing only that there was a chance, if the bleeding stopped and the swelling went down, that she might come out of the coma. But they had no idea what mental state she would be in. A week into Judy's stay, after a long afternoon visit, I was going down the elevator when we stopped to let others on. The doors opened and Arbor walked back into my life. She had been in Florida for 2 weeks and was on her way home when a friend called her and told her about Judy. She had driven 24 hours straight through, rested overnight in Eureka, and then drove 2 hours to see Judy that afternoon. I looked at her and time stood still. and I felt joy for the first time in my life. Up until that moment, all I knew to ask the universe for was happiness. I found out that day that there is a difference. Before I left the hospital that day, I had Arbor's name and phone number written on a tiny piece of paper that I did not lose. We talked to each other every day as Judy slowly came out of the fog and recovered. I fell in love with Arbor's voice and her beautiful face at Ozark Natural Foods. She fell in love with my spirit over those long phone calls talking about our dear friend Judy. Judy's connection to all her lesbian friends is the reason we fell in love. 23 years later, we are still in love. And we still remember one particular phone call. "Mr. Jesus," Arbor said. "How did she come up with Mr. Jesus from a cartoon cow with pink udders?" "I have no idea," I told her. "No idea." You see, Judy saw Mr. Jesus that day, and I just saw an angel.
Rebecca Buchanan is a poet who lives just down that dirt road in Winslow, Arkansas. Born and raised in the Ozarks, Rebecca has a new book of poetry, The Red Bear with Extremely White Teeth. So how about our stories and LGBT storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at the Oyster Bar. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops. And tonight's show is sponsored by the Arkansas Stonewall Democratic Caucus. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Dairy Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Arkansas Times, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from all Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
That I wrote, gosh, years and years ago, and I hadn't played it in probably 20 years, but thinking about the theme of tonight's show, ending hate, and I brought it back out. I get chills thinking about it. It's called Personal.
Well, I heard an old man say I wouldn't be put away if these were the good old days, not like they will now. Finally, a few years since the plow. Skin against the iron gate, allegiance as solid as this man's hate. Like a step outside my front door and see a beautifully colored world.
For
when
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.